June 8, 2003. Dear Uncle Richie, things are going well. There's a lot of talk about us being reassigned. The thing is that we are officially attached to the 3RDID. Some of the older non-coms are saying it's all part of Rumsfeld's yo-yo concept. We're all on strings and he jerks us around where he wants us. I don't know if I will be reassigned to the 422ND or another CA unit or back to my original unit from 4 Dicks. That would suck because they haven't been over here yet. I can use some Harlem. One thing I miss over here is the music you hear walking down the streets at home. We got one of the construction guys to rig us up a little portable amplifier so we can blast out the Humvee as we go down the street. They have a lot of amplifiers over here that they use to aggravate the Iraqis. A car bomb went off near a Sunni mosque yesterday. The Marines call the car bombs mist makers. They say that when you're hit with one of those major explosions, all that's left is a pink mist. There's more and more fighting between the Sunnis, not that many of them, really, and the Shiites. I don't really understand the differences between them, they all follow Islam. Still, if they blow each other up and you're too close, it doesn't matter if there's a big difference or a little one. One had the chance to speak to Mom the other day and we were having a good conversation and all of a sudden she started crying. If you see her, will you tell her that I'm actually okay and not just putting on a brave face? I don't think I have a brave face. They don't send the CAs into areas they expect resistance, they send the Marines in, the infantry, and man, those guys are deadly. They go after everything with such confidence and job-like determination. I'm glad I'm not going up against them. Don't get me wrong, I don't want to go up against the Iraqis either. I just want to do my hit to make this place a little hit safer before I leave. Give everybody my love. Robin, yo, Bertie, you know what we need over here, man? Jonesy had bought a cheap guitar from a guy in supply and was trying to tune it.
What?
An Arabic dictionary so we can see if the names of places we go into mean anything, he said. Aymara could mean the gaping ghetto or something. I found it on the map, I said. Yeah, I seen it too, Jonesy said. About an inch away from Iran. I got a bad feeling about this mess. I looked at him to see if he was kidding. He wasn't. How come? I asked. They're giving us some time off, and they handpicking people instead of just sending out some numbers. Somebody thinking this is some serious business. They think we can handle it, I said. I hope they're right, Jonesy said. We picked up new gear from the supply sergeant in Isalia. It was all the same stuff except for the pistols. I hadn't carried a pistol. But we had shot them in training. I didn't want to be so close to anybody again that I had to use a pistol. The M16 at 100 meters was fine with me. We got a final briefing from Kelly that didn't sound good. I kept checking Jonesy and he looked worried. The whole area between the southern tip of Iraq north through the Mysen province is supposed to be held by the British, Kelly said. They're way undermanned and trying to work with the civilians to keep things cool. They've had a lot of success with their civil affairs ops and we're hoping for the same thing. If they had so much success, how come we're going? Marla asked. We've got some people in the area too, Kelly said, smiling. They're just more used to working with Americans. We only going to be there for this one set? Jonesy asked. Who coming to hear us play? There are two main groups in the area. The good guys are the ones who have always lived there. They're good people, but they rose up against Saddam in the early 90s and he tried to wipe them out. This was a marsh area and they made their living off the water and rice farming, which demands a lot of water. Saddam drained the marshes and mined the area. They hate his guts, Kelly went on. We just found out that some of their children have been kidnapped and are being held for ransom. Kidnapping's big business over here. We think we can use that to our advantage. The local tribe that the children belong to has been, or at least we think has been, dealing with some of the BADR fighters who are coming across the border from Iran. The BADR fighters are the bad guys in this picture. Many are former Iraqis. They're all Shiites and all anti-Saddam. But the intelligence is that they're being supported by some foreign elements. Iran? Captain Coles asked. We haven't verified that, Kelly said. And we haven't verified that they're absolutely the ones bringing in the new detonators we are finding throughout the country either. If we get our hands on a supply of the detonators, we might be able to trace them directly to the source. If we can do that, we might be able to exert enough behind-the-scenes pressure to stop the flow. What we think is that the BADR fighters are bringing in the detonators and selling them to the locals, who then bring them into the suburbs around Baghdad. Yo, let me get this straight, sir. Jonesy was deep into his gangsta lean. The bad guys are bringing in detonators so we know they bad, right? Right, Kelly answered. And the good guys are dealing with the bad guys but we know they the good guys because they was hating Saddam first. They need to eat, soldier, the same as everybody else over here, Kelly said, his voice going flat. But they want their kids back and we're offering you guys up as first-class negotiators. The guys we have in the area now will help you get the kids and, hopefully, we'll make a lot of friends. And you asked for women because... Miller's head was turned to one side. If you need reasons, Captain, I'll give them to you. Kelly had gone from flat to pissed. The first is that I've seen what the new detonators and the new shaped charges we're finding can do to our people. I've scraped the pieces of flesh from the sides of burned out vehicles so the insurgents don't get them and feed them to their dogs. I've seen the blood of guys I respect change the color of the air around a vehicle. I'd send my mother if I thought it would do any good. I didn't like Kelly sounding off to Captain Miller, and I knew he didn't like us questioning him. I hope they at least have the good sense to wear white hats and black hats so we can tell them apart, Marla said as we headed back to our quarters. 0300 hours. We were driven to an airfield where an old, dull-looking C-3 transport plane crouched on the runway. The night was hot and the interior of the C-3 stifling. I felt myself sucking in air through my mouth. Bertie, you're sucking in bugs, Darcy said. I need the protein, I answered. Captain Coles was being quiet and I wondered if he knew anything the rest of us didn't. Hey, Captain, what you got to say? I called to him. He undid his straps and stood up. I just think everybody needs to get their game face on for this mission, he said. He stepped over Miller's legs and headed to the John in the back of the plane. Look at it this way, Miller spoke up. They wouldn't be sending four women on a mission if it was all that dangerous. Not that big of a crap for us, but it'll look bad in the papers. Did I ever tell you about the time my cousin Jedi was on the front page of the Memphis Appeal for robbing a Piggly Wiggly on New Year's Eve? Jonesy asked. He got all the way to Panama City, Florida. When he called back home and found out he was on the front page, he went back to Stone Mountain. Got arrested, got 6 months, served 3, but he been a celebrity ever since. Colts got back from the John and was just settled in when the hatches were shut and the C-3 took off. The flight to Aimra took nearly 2.5 hours. Colts said the pilots must have been flying around hot zones. We had a vote and it was agreed 7-0 that flying around hot zones was a good idea. I'm supposed to tell you, once we get in the air, that we are going to be working with some special ops troops who are already in place in the marshes, Cole said. They've been there since the first of the year. Who are they? Marla asked. Cole shrugged. 0620 hours Aimra was hot and stinky. We deplaned and got into trucks for the bumpy ride to a long stretch of wall. There were towers along the inside of the wall at intervals of 100 yards. The truck was checked by a British Marine who actually looked under the carriage for something. Then we were taken through a yard the size of a supermarket parking lot to a squat, dirty building that stunk even more. The coalition took out the electricity before we arrived, an officer said. So it's all a bit backed up. We were given a room to sit in for the next hour and a half. The Brits and a few Japanese were sitting at computers in the compound. All of the computers were laptops and none plugged into anything. Compared to Baghdad, this was pure crap. We waited in full gear until nearly 1200 when a young-looking Brit lieutenant asked Captain Coles if we were ready to go. Coles said no, that we wanted to eat first, and the lieutenant said we could eat when we landed. Lieutenant, my soldiers need to eat first, Coles said slowly, deliberately. Captain, you have about 15 minutes to get your people on your transport, the lieutenant said. If they are not on, you're going to be quite sorry. Captain Miller, who curses better than anyone I have ever heard, said some wonderful things about the lieutenant's parents that I wish I had had the time to write down, even though I didn't really believe that a human being could be conceived by sand crabs under a flat rock. 12:30 hours. According to the chopper pilot, we were landing 5 miles southeast of Aimra. Good luck, he chirped. The place looked desolate. To our left there were huge patches of dark green soil. To the right there was fog. We had been dropped with our gear and 2 crates of medical supplies in a clearing. Coles was on the radio asking the pilot if he was sure that this was where we were supposed to be when the choppers took off. I could hear the pilot's voice in Coles's headset as the wind from the rotors blew dust in my face. Company, Marla announced. There were 3 vehicles coming toward us. I couldn't see the drivers and I didn't recognize the trucks.
Easy. Easy.
Coles said. I felt the weight of my piece and toyed lightly with the trigger. As they drew near, we saw one guy standing on the sideboard waving. He was wearing camouflage gear and a bandana around his head. We were all frozen in our spots when they reached us. You guys bring any beer? The first guy out of what looked like an up-armored SUV asked. Afraid not, Cole said. Man, we've been waiting for the beer run for 6 months, the guy said, extending his hand. Pile into that second wagon and we'll take you to the camp. We loaded the medical supplies in the second vehicle and tried not to stare too hard at the men. We could only guess that they were soldiers, who were staring at us. They were a motley crew. Big. Muscled, in a variety of uniforms. Some wore bandanas around their heads, others wore earrings. Who are you guys? Coles asked. Fifth group, one guy said. We work with the local tribes. These were the guys that Marla had called hoodlums back in Kuwait. They had left Camp Bathan before us and nobody knew where they had been headed. We got into the trucks and headed to their camp at a speed that I was sure was going to kill us all. I looked at Marla across from me and she looked tense. When we arrived at the camp, it wasn't what I expected. It was a small village. There were dark tents huddled together on one end of a field and small round huts made out of sticks and mud at the other. But most of all, there were people that I knew were not soldiers. We were in a tribal camp and I was hoping that I hadn't misread the guys who picked us up. I was hoping that they were really American soldiers. We trailed the guys who had picked us up into the camp. I stopped once to see a dark woman, dressed all in black, staring at me with eyes that looked 1,000 years old. I smiled. She didn't. We were led into a slightly larger tent where a bare-chested white guy sat in front of a low fire. A woman, slight with quick, nervous movements, sat next to him. Make yourself at home, the white man drawled. Y'all eat? I'm Captain Coles. My people could use something to eat. Colonel Roberts was the reply. We'll get you some food and you can lay up until it gets dark. We got some work to do tonight, so you need to be rested. Sorry, our hospitality couldn't be more considerate, but we got us a situation, so to speak. People working before you, including us, haven't got the job done. That's why you folks are here. We understand you're pretty good. We're trying, the same as you, Captain Coles replied. Yeah, well, that's good, Captain, Roberts said. So, what we're going to do is to have you meet the locals this evening. They're coming here? Captain Coles asked. No, we'll send in all of your people to their camp with 4 of ours for security, Roberts said. I don't think they'll try anything rough with your people, and with ours there they won't try to intimidate you. They've been told that you're a crack negotiating team from CENTCOM and that you're willing to spend our government's money to ransom the kids from a rival tribe. These are the kids of one of their religious leaders. So it's important for the chief to get the kids back to show he's still got juice. If it's that important to him, why do we have to convince him? Coles asked. Because they don't trust anybody who isn't a blood cousin. They've been betrayed by the Iraqis, by the Iranians, by anyone who has anything to gain in this area, Roberts said. The only difference between this place and everywhere else in this country is this place doesn't make the news. Roberts gave us a map and pointed out a place that we would meet after dark to make the exchange. We'll give you one kit to take with you to show we can get them out, Roberts said.
You already have one of them?
Marla asked.
We have all of them, Roberts said, glancing toward Miller.
They were kidnapped as a favor to us.
So it's true, we can't be trusted?
Miller asked. After the war we can sit down and have a drink someplace, Roberts said.
We get a good enough buzz on, we'll talk about the philosophy of war.
Until then we'll do what we have to do to keep our people alive.
We were fed.
The food was good.
I thought it was lamb with carrots and couscous.
The stick and mud hut we were in looked something like old pictures of American Indian homes.
The funny thing is,
Captain Coles was holding a piece of meat on the end of a stick.
In a way we are getting closer to the people we are dealing with.
I don't trust Roberts either.
What are we going to do?
Miller asked.
What we're told and hope he gets us out of here alive, he said.
And I hope he's right about the detonators and that we're actually going to be doing some good.
Roberts came in with a young man dressed in black.
He moved into the shadows against the wall and almost disappeared.
Roberts had a dark green sack with him which he tossed down in front of us.
We shut down the conversation as he sat.
The food's good, huh?
It's okay, Marla said.
If we thought we could pull this off without you guys, you wouldn't be here, Roberts said.
But we think you're going to do just fine.
Fadil here is going to translate for you.
He was a student at Basra College.
Is there a chance they'll try to renege on the deal and just off our people and take the kids?
Jonesy asked.
That's what I would do if I was them, Roberts said.
I was scared out of my freaking mind.
These special ops guys were physically and mentally as tough as they came, but there were stories about some of them not being wrapped too tight.
From what I had seen of them, I believed it.
Roberts opened the sack and showed us the money we were going to be using.
You'll tell them that you're going to be using the money to buy the kids' safety, he said.
And try to hang on to it.
20:30 was an hour after sunset when we mounted up. The stink from the marshes was mixed with sewer smells and cooking.
My stomach was queasy and the aftertaste from the meal didn't help any.
Two of Roberts's people were in the first SUV.
Me, Jonesy, Coles, and Marla were in the second, with a driver chewing on an unlit cigar.
Miller and Owens and the translator were in the last vehicle with the fourth security guy and a kid.
They had put a sack over the kid's head.
I felt sorry for him, or her, I didn't know which.
What I was wondering was whether the security guys were there to protect us or to watch us.
The guy driving our vehicle, he said his name was Gambarali, was short and wide, with a big head that seemed to come out of his chest.
His teeth were perfectly lined up so when he smiled, or maybe he was smiling, it was hard to tell, they lined up like teeth in a kid's drawing.
I ever tell you about doing stuff you don't want to tell your mama about?
Jonesy asked.
That what we doing?
Marla asked.
That's what we doing, Jonesy said.
Gambarali got a big kick out of that.
That's good.
That's real good.
I'm going to tell all the guys about that.
I thought about my father.
An image of him sitting on his chair near our front room window came to mind.
He didn't know how much I wanted things to be okay between us.
What I wanted was for him to look at me and see me in the moment, and not worry about what I was going to do or how I was going to kick it 10 years down the line.
I hoped if anything happened to me he would be all right with it.
I knew Mama would be sad, but she wouldn't feel mad.
Mama wasn't like that.
We drove west for a while and then made a right turn toward the east.
We were on the road longer than I thought we would be, maybe 25 minutes, maybe a half hour.
I knew that Ayi Amra was only 30 miles from the Iranian border, but I didn't know how he had traveled to get to the tribal camp.
After a while I saw the flicker of lights ahead in the darkness.
Torches.
I thought I could see figures.
I felt my testicles shrivel.
I think they know we're coming, I said.
Yeah, you don't want to surprise anybody out here unless you plan on killing them, our driver said.
Don't get spooked.
Everything's cool, just don't get spooked.
He was spooking me out all by himself.
A string of clouds drifted across the three-quarter moon, sending shadows everywhere.
The driver slowed the vehicle down and then we stopped in front of two guys who pointed their AK-47s in our direction. They said something and Fettel told us all to get out. The air was still and there was a swarm of tiny bugs flying in front of my face. I saw Owens taking the hood off of the kid. He was wide-eyed and sly, but good-looking. We were led through a maze of tents and small groups of men, huddled together in the darkness. I knew I was walking stiff-leggedly, but I couldn't help myself. My mouth was dry and I wondered if I would be able to speak when the time came. We were led into a tent that was up against a hill. We went through the tent into a one-story semi-square building. For some reason I expected Osama bin Laden or somebody to be sitting inside of it. They had electric lights set up and it was fairly bright. There was a rug on the ground and rugs along the wall. We stopped inside and the men who had brought us in, two older guys dressed in caftans and sandals, pointed to the ground. We started to sit. I saw Miller with her arm around the shoulders of the child we had brought along. The Iraqis didn't even glance in the kid's direction and I wondered if there had been some mistake. We waited nearly 10 minutes in silence until four more men came into the cave from the same way that we had entered. They were followed by a man carrying pillows. The pillows were put down and the four new guys sat on them. They looked us over and spoke among themselves. They looked at the boy and one of the men nodded. That was a relief. He said something and one of the men with a gun took the boy by the hand and led him out of the cave. Then they continued talking among themselves. Fettel leaned toward us. They are saying that the women are probably prostitutes, he said softly. Remember that they probably understand English too. So you tell me what you want. Cole sniffed twice and started talking. He spoke in a low voice and I thought it was probably because we were all so close together. He said we were willing to talk to the people who had taken the children. We believe we can get them back without any harm coming to them, he said. And what do you want? The guy speaking was my complexion, at least he looked brownish in the dim light, and maybe 100 years old. We understand you have some detonators that interest us, Cole said. The old man shrugged, and spoke to the others. They all shrugged. It reminded me of hanging out in the barber shop on Saturday and the old youths wanted to mess with the young bloods. He spoke to Fettel, who turned to us slowly. He says he doesn't know what the American is talking about, Fettel said. What are detonators? Cole shook his head slowly, then stood. We all stood and watched as Cole extended his hand to the elder Afghani. The two men shook hands briefly and we started out of the cave. Wait. Fettel stopped us just as we reached the flap that covered the entrance. The chief has something else to say. We stood for what seemed forever. My right leg was aching. I had never noticed that before. The old man I thought might have been a chief spoke very softly to the man on his left. He was also ancient-looking and wore a kind of half-turban the same silver-white color of his beard. The fire reflected in his beard and eyes and gave him a mystical look. The chief went on for a while but the other man didn't speak. Occasionally he would raise his hands, then turn the palms up and out, as if he weren't sure of himself. My stomach was hurting now. Then I realized that if we were suddenly attacked, I wouldn't even be nearly ready. I looked at Jonesy and Miller and they were just as absorbed in the conversation between the two men still seated on the floor as I was. Finally the chief spoke to Fettel, who in turn asked Coles for the map. Fettel got down on his knees and showed the old man the meeting place. Show them the money, Coles said to me. I fumbled with the bag, finally got it opened, and folded my hands so no one would see them shaking. None of the Iraqis looked at it. They were so cool. Another of the men spoke to Fettel, who answered in a different tone of voice. The man spoke to him again and Fettel bowed his head and did the same palms up gesture as the older man had done. Then there were nods all around and Fettel told me to pick up the money. A minute later we were out of the cave and headed back to the vehicles. We do it? Marla asked. We did it, Fettel said. What was that last bit of conversation? Coles asked. When the other guy spoke to you. He wanted to know who my people were. And if they knew I worked for non-believers. I thought of the kid walking around touching all the Americans saying, infidel, infidel, infidel. We were supposed to meet in 1 hour and we would just have enough time, if we tore through the darkness at a clip fast enough to kill us all, to make it. Roberts timed this too closely, Cole said. There's an old proverb they say in the marshes, Fadil said. Chiefs sleep on anthills. If he sleeps on it, he's going to be bothered all night and by the morning he will have changed his mind 5 times. We were elated on the way back. I was worried about IEDs on the road, but I didn't think too much about them. The thing that gets me, Marla said, is that if either side blows us away, they're going to think they at least got something out of the deal. Fadil radioed ahead and Roberts and his team met us on the road. Fadil, they buy our story? Roberts asked. No, but they think we can get the kids, Fadil said. I thought bringing in decent-looking people might help the situation, Roberts said, grinning. We pull this off and I'm putting myself up for general. Roberts had the other kids brought out and put them into the vehicle with Miller. Is that kid? Miller squinted. Blind, Roberts said. We build ourselves another life, Captain, and I'll come back over here with you to help these people. In the meanwhile, if anybody has to pee or anything, do it now and get on your way. If it starts going down wrong, get into your vehicles and bug the hell out. Our vehicles have armored plates on the sides, and if you don't get a direct hit with an RPG or take a straight-on shot from our AK-47, you have a good chance of making it. These people shoot and run quick. They don't want to tangle with my men. We lack sympathy. I felt like I had to pee but couldn't go. There was an eerie sound coming from the camp. I thought it was chanting and asked Fadil if they were praying for us. That guy's buffalo is sick, Roberts said. He's singing to it to make it feel better. He's only got that one buffalo, so he gets priority. Great. Bertie. It was Jonesy. I get that blues club, you going to come down to Memphis to check it out? I get free drinks? All you're narrow but can handle. Jonesy put his hand up and I slapped him 5. Bet. I was more relaxed as we set out. Having the kids to deliver made me feel better. I could tell Marla was more relaxed too. She was running her mouth about how she hadn't made it on the debating squad at Half Hollow Hills. What I should do is get me a Humvee and hook it up with a sound system and a squad gun, she said. Then I'll put on the survivor cut and blast it up to decibel heaven as I blow away all the old biddies picking the debating team. It won't be the same ones that didn't pick you, I said. Bertie, the whole deal's symbolic. Don't be so lame, man, Marla said. Driving through the night was spooky, scary, but we had done okay so far. We were actually dealing with these people far off the beaten track. I hoped we were saving lives. Even Miller looked okay. Or at least as okay as Miller ever looked. We got to the place on the map where we were supposed to meet the Iraqis and Gombarali pulled off to one side. They're here, he said. I can smell them. I looked at him to see if he was kidding. He wasn't. Roberts's guys got out first and quickly disappeared into the darkness. For a wild moment the thought came to me that I wasn't sure if they were really good guys after all. Put it out of your mind. Coles and Miller were getting the children out. It was beginning to rain and had grown cool. I wondered if the children were cold. I pulled down my night vision goggles, couldn't see crap, and pushed them back up. Miller and Coles pushed the kids forward. Fadil was with them. Bertie. Move up with us. Cole spoke in a loud whisper. We walked toward what looked like a shimmer in the fog. As I got near, I could see the outline of a rifle. From the angle, it was on someone's back with a sling across his chest. A shift in the moon and I could see 3 figures. Each one stood behind a box. Fadil stepped forward and greeted them in Arabic. I checked the safety on my weapon. The 3 figures were young men. They piled the boxes down in front of Fadil. Take a look, Bertie. Crap, I didn't want to look away from the guys. Stepping forward as I fumbled for my flashlight, I realized I wasn't sure what I was supposed to be seeing. I lifted the first box. It was lighter than I thought. For some reason that was reassuring. At least it wasn't going to be a 105mm shell rigged to miss me. The box was unsealed and I put my hand in it. I felt something in plastic and put the flashlight on the contents. There was a row of blue tubes, two, maybe 3 inches long, each with two wires sticking out of one end. A quick guess said there were at least 100 in the box. They looked like detonators to me, I said. Take them back to the truck, Cole said. I could lift all 3 boxes easily and was glad to be moving away. I got the boxes into the vehicles I had come in. By the time I turned, Coles and Miller were almost back with me. Behind them I saw the children disappear into the darkness. I heard one of the Iraqis speak and saw the children squat down quickly. The kids are, I didn't have a chance to finish the sentence before the first shots rang out. The flame from the muzzle of the AK-47 leaped up. The figure for a hot moment and I could see the guy sliding off to the right. The children. Miller was screaming. From behind me I heard the answering fire from Roberts' men. Move it out. Move it out. Coles was shouting. The sound of a machine gun came from our side of the road and a grenade went off a short distance from where the Iraqis had been standing. Then there was a sudden and awful silence. Mount up. Mount up. Coles's voice was higher, more urgent. We were getting into the vehicles when we heard another sound. It was one of the children. He was crying. One of them is hurt. Miller. Leave him. Coles. I could see the child. It was the blind boy, his hands up in front of him, pushing against the darkness. Then I saw a figure, it was Jonesy, running toward him. Jonesy's out there. I called out. Crouching, I headed toward them. Jonesy had grabbed the child around his chest and was covering his body with his own. Get out of here! Get out of here! One of Roberts's men. For a moment I lost sight of Jonesy. Then I saw him get to his knees. Stay low. I yelled. Stay low. I felt a sharp pain in my foot slip out from under me. More bullets hit the ground to my left and suddenly I was firing into the darkness. Then an explosion, it had to be 50 yards in front of me, lit up the night sky. The impact of it lifted me off the ground and backward. Then I was being pulled to my feet. I looked up and saw Gombarelli, eyes staring straight ahead, a pistol at arm's length pumping bullets in the direction the explosion had gone off. I half walked, half got dragged back to the vehicle and slid in. Marla was behind the wheel and as soon as the door closed, she spun it around. Where's Jonesy? They're taking him to the other truck, she said. He's hit. He's hit. I was sprawled across the back seat of the truck as we spun in the road. We started after the first truck with Marla pushing within 10 feet of its rear. 20 seconds down the road, we saw the rest of Roberts's men in SUVs and Humvees lining the road. I glanced at the rearview mirror. There weren't any lights following us. It took forever to get back to the camp. There were torches lit everywhere and guys running around with automatic rifles as Roberts was setting up some kind of a defense. I stumbled through the confusion looking for Jonesy. Then I saw two guys carrying someone into one of the huts. Miller was pushing her way past us to get to him. They were putting him down on the ground as I reached them. Jonesy's eyes were open and his hand was moving near his neck, as if he were trying to brush something away. I looked and saw a bubble of blood swell and disappear. Give him some air. Miller was on her knees next to him and cutting away his uniform. Give him some air. I hobbled outside and tried to breathe. A burning pain seared through my left leg. There were streaks in the sky and the first signs of morning. What to do? Where to put my eyes? What to think? It had been so long since I had prayed. So long. Oh Jesus God, please don't let him die. Oh, please don't let him die. Oh God, please don't let him die. Oh, please. Oh, man, God, please don't let him die. Not Jonesy, God. Please. I sat down on a pile of sandbags and realized how tired I was. There was a lot of activity around me and I looked up and saw Roberts's guys stringing concertina wire around the perimeter of the camp. I figured they must have been expecting an attack. The M16 felt heavy in my arms. 2 deep breaths gave me enough energy to head back to the tent where Jonesy lay. I envisioned him sitting up, telling some story about his blues joint. When I got into the tent, he was still lying at the far side, the flames from the low fire casting a reddish glow to his skin. "You were wounded." Miller was on her knees near Jonesy's feet and started toward me. "Let me take a look at you." "Deal with Jonesy," I said. "I'm okay." She stopped where she was, still kneeling, head down, hands folded in front of her thighs. "Captain Miller?" I called to her. She looked up at me. Her face, pale and drawn, looked as if she were in shock. "I'm sorry," she said. "I'm so sorry." She began to sob, and then to wail. It was as if something horrible and ugly were pouring out of her. "I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry." She was shouting the words. Moaning the words. They were coming from deep inside her and filled the tiny space we were in. They broke against the walls in a thousand tortured shards that said that Jonesy was dead. Several of the Iraqi women came to her. They began to put their arms around her. Now they were talking softly to her. Now they added their wails to hers. Jonesy was dead. Somehow she got herself together and looked at my leg. There was an ugly cut just below my knee and a huge swelling that bled lower on the side of my ankle. The leg looked different, raw and ugly, as if it was something other than a leg. I was ashamed of the fact that it hurt so much and that I could still feel the pain when Jonesy couldn't. Miller gave me a shot in the leg that eased it quickly and told me to get some rest. I didn't want rest. I wanted to be outside if we were attacked. I wanted to hurt something, to make something right. "But what?" "Roberts." His mouth moving. He babbles on about the success of the mission. "Sorry about your buddy," he said. "We're calling in a bomb strike. Keep their heads down," he said. "The detonators were just what we thought they would be. They're traceable," he said. "There are parts numbers on them which encode the country of origin." "Babble. Babble," he said. "Detonators and photocells. Don't know what they're for. But you guys did well. I don't think they'll attack," he said. "Babble. Babble. I see he is elated with the detonators. They will save lives. But not enough lives. This I know for sure. I found Marla." She was bent over, her arms around her shoulders, rocking from side to side. "Marla." I put my arm around her. She turned to me, the tears streaming down her face. "If there is a God." Her face was stretched tight in her anguish. "If there's a God, Bertie, where the hell is he hiding?" "There was no attack. A day of waiting and watching. A night of bad dreams, of living again the moments that flashed wildly by and that I was already not sure really existed as memory danced them in my tired brain. Those moments and countless images of body bags holding my friend, my blues-loving friend. A chopper to Aimra. A transport to Baghdad." Marla sat next to me, leaned against me, and put her hand on my leg. Miller sat apart from us. She was miserable, but we were all so equally miserable that we couldn't comfort her. I thought of the Iraqi women. How long had they known the griefs they shared? In Baghdad there was packing going on. I put clothing into my duffel bag, deciding what to take, what to leave behind. There were questions. What happened on the mission? How did Jonesy get it? There were many questions and I tried to answer them with some logic. But over and over I thought that we were in a war of complete randomness. Death was hiding in every shadow, lurking along every roadway, flying through the midday air. It came suddenly and randomly. There was no logic except the constant adding up of numbers. How many are dead? What are the names? Where are the pictures for the hometown papers? As we line up for the memorial service, I think of the blind child, his arms outstretched as if he were feeling for answers in his eternal darkness. And I am glad for him, that he lived for those frantic moments, even though I believe I will forget him with the passage of time. For Miller running toward him, and Jonesy giving up his dreams for that child, was what lifted all of this above fear and loathing. In that one last desperate moment, there was actually something for the blind child to reach, some higher point of humanity. Does anyone know what religion the young man was? The chaplain asked. He was a blues man, Marla answered. And an American, Miller added. A damn good American. The question stopped. The service went on. Lord, have mercy on us as we feel the pain of loss, and the endless emptiness that marks the passing of our brother, and have mercy on us as we feel sorrow for ourselves, and for all the angel warriors for whom we feel kinship. Let death be swallowed up in the victory of righteousness. Let us fear death, but let it not dwell within us. Protect us, O Lord, and be merciful unto us. Amen. Roll call officer. Major Sessions, at the back of the tent, marched forward, stopping in front of the first row of chairs. She looked down at her clipboard, and then up. Jones. She called, her voice wavering. Again, the unbearable silence, the longing to answer. Corporal Charles Jones. The stillness between heartbeats held for what seemed an eternity before giving way to the grieving melody of taps. There weren't enough tears within what was left of our squads to wash away the moment. And all the prayers and words of comfort were not enough to hold the griefs we shared. Still, we had to summon the strength to walk out of the memorial tent again, and into the brilliant Iraqi sun with the getting on of our lives. When Miller saw me, she stopped, looked up at me, with her head tilted slightly back, and covered her eyes from the brightness as if to see me more clearly. We looked at each other for a moment, and then she nodded and went on. There was nothing that needed to be said. We got new assignments. All the specialists, the construction people and the plumbers and the electricians from our flying squad were reassigned to the 422ND. They were given some time off and the option to apply for other units. The rest of us, Coles, Evans, Jean Darcy, Harris, were being recycled back through a training process center. I had been wounded and received a Purple Heart. Marla told me to stick out my tongue to see if that was purple too. If your tongue is purple, it means you can poison them when you bite them, she announced. We turned in our weapons to supply and then there was the coming together in the saying of goodbye. It wasn't complete, wasn't over in any real sense. I looked at Marla and hugged her for as long as we could stand it. Bertie, you're a trip, she said. We swore that we would always be in touch. I would call her 1,000 times and she would write to me and we would huddle together over the years. I told her, for the first time, that I loved her. Bertie, when people shoot at you, she said, you automatically love everybody that's ducking down with you. Is that all there is to it? No, but it's all I have the courage to deal with right now. Marla put her arm around my neck and kissed me lightly on the cheek. But I'm thinking heavy on you, Bertie boy. I'm giving you a lot of thought. The goodbyes were hard and filled with tears and promises. We were all going to stay in touch forever, and to keep one another in our prayers and thoughts. There were handshakes and hugs. And Marla coming back to me and putting her fingers to my lips so that I wouldn't speak and holding me for a long moment. Then we were at the airport again. Marla was going to Incirlik Air Force Base in Turkey and from there back to the States to train new CA ops. Captain Coles, Sergeant Harris, and RC were going to Doha and I was going to Ramstein, in Germany, to have my wounds taken care of and then I would be reassigned. Everybody else was assigned to the 422ND and, for the most part, they were happy. I wondered what Jonesy's blues place would have looked like. If he could have pulled it off. I wanted to think he could. June 11, 2003, Dear Uncle Richie, there's no way that I mail this letter off. Coles and Marla and Evans and all of my squad buddies are gone to their new assignments. Captain Miller left last night before I had a chance to say goodbye to her. Her original unit was rotated back to the States and she went with them even though they never left Qatar. Uncle Richie, I just wanted to write down that I did what I thought I had to do over here. I did it for my country and for the people, one love, and for myself too. At least that's what I'm telling myself. But there's a distance between what my brain says I'm doing, which is more or less what the missions tell us that we're doing, and what I'm feeling inside. I think you probably know that too. I got the New York Times today. It was several days old, but there's nothing on the front page about the war, or about Iraq. Inside there is a small square with the names of two more Kias. I touched the names with my fingertips, but I couldn't feel the people they represented. I'm sorry about that. Mama said that I shouldn't be the hero type. I don't know. Maybe you have to be a hero type to deal with the bigger things that happen to you. At least you have to be bigger than life to fit all the things inside that you didn't know you could absorb before. I never thought I would see the things I have seen. So many people dead. So many with their parts blown off and them bleeding and crying. I've had to cram all of these images into my head, and it's not easy. I try to think about how I would tell people about my experiences over here. I was thinking that if there comes a day when someone says that we have won this war, I know that I'll have doubts inside. The ones who make it home are just survivors. If there's any real winning, it's that, once we get home, we'll know for sure the things we're living for. And, hopefully, we'll be more thankful for all those things. If there comes a day that someone says that we have lost this war, I'll know that they are wrong too. Because once you have seen a Jonesy or a Pendleton desperately reaching for the highest idea of life, offering themselves up, you don't think about losing or winning so much. You think there is more to life and you go on and you want to find that something more. The funny thing is that the people I loved over here, my guys, could become strangers to me. What I mean is that I saw them here, and was afraid with them and cried with them here, but would I even recognize them if I saw them out there in the world? Would Marla be the same without her body armor? Or without her blonde hair tucked up under her Kevlar? How about Coles or Jean Darcy? Would they look different to me in the supermarket? What was Captain Miller about? How big is her heart? If I saw her riding a bus, maybe reading a newspaper, would I recognize her? I don't think so. I don't know if I will ever know anybody again. Can I ever hear the blues again without crying? Uncle Richie, I'm glad I won't mail this letter to you. Because the hardest thing to say is that I don't know if God and I would recognize each other. Why would he let such crap go on like this? How come there's so much pain in the world if he has anything to say about it? What kind of a God is this? The thought came to me that all of this, the training and the bombing and the people being shot, children and old people, and women and crazy ass guys on drugs, all of it might have been part of God's plan. I'm not saying it was or even if I believe in any of it anymore. I don't know. If I do talk about the war, maybe I'll try to tell people about a blind Iraqi kid stumbling across the field, bullets flying around him, lost in his dark world. Uncle Richie, I used to be mad with you when you wouldn't talk about Vietnam. I thought you were being selfish, in a way. Now I understand how light the words seem. If I ever have kids, I think I won't tell them much about what I did here, or what I've seen. I'll tell them something because I'll want them to know about war. But are there really enough words to make them understand? Your favorite nephew, Robin, also known as Birdie. Glossary, at 10, a U.S. jet fighter bomber used for close air combat, AK-47, the first true automatic assault weapon. Manufactured in Russia during the Cold War. Widely, often illegally, traded and used in conflicts throughout the world, Al Jazeera, a worldwide Arabic satellite and cable network, based in Doha, Qatar, that has widely expanded the availability of media in the Middle East. Commonly gives the viewpoints of the Islamic world. Al-Qaeda, a loosely organized, radical, international terrorist organization whose goals are to get rid of foreign influences in Islamic countries and establish a world order based on strict, fundamentalist Islamic laws. Al-Qaeda was founded in 1989 by Osama bin Laden, among others. The United States, with its worldwide influence, has been particularly targeted by bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, which uses bombings and other forms of tactical violence to further its goals. CENTCOM, the United States Central Command, under the control of the Secretary of Defense, is in charge of coordinating military affairs for the U.S. Armed Forces in the Middle East, Central Asia, and East Africa. CENTCOM is headquartered in Tampa, Florida. Civil Affairs, branch of the U.S. Armed Forces that acts as a liaison between the military and the civilians in a war zone or disaster area. Coalition, the military forces deployed from other countries to join the U.S. military in Operation Iraqi Freedom. At various points during the Operation Iraqi Freedom campaign, More than 30 countries have been listed as part of the coalition, although the great majority of combat forces are from the US, followed by the United Kingdom. Most countries sent significantly smaller forces, which were often limited to support roles, rather than combat or engagement. Detonator, a device used to trigger an explosive. Fedayeen, a group of guerrilla fighters loyal to Saddam Hussein. Final roll gale, a military ritual in the memorial services for slain personnel. POP, Forward Operations Base. A military base that is located near the front lines of combat, Green Zone, the heavily fortified area in central Baghdad from which coalition command decisions are made. Gulf War, Iraq invaded neighboring Kuwait in August 1990. In January 1991, United Nations sanctioned troops, in a coalition led primarily by the United States, waged the Persian Gulf War to liberate Kuwait, which was accomplished by February 1991. HMMVW, a hybrid vehicle, outfitted for a number of different military purposes, with a top speed of 80 miles per hour. Commonly called a Humvee, IED, an improvised explosive device. Insurgents, people fighting in armed revolt against a civil, military, or political authority. Islam, a religion based on the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad. Followers of Islam are called Muslims. Jihad, a system of protecting Islamic beliefs. There are traditionally four methods of practicing jihad. I. With the heart, doing what is right under Islamic law. 2. With the tongue, speaking the truth and propagating Islam. 3. With the hand, correcting what one sees is wrong. 4. With the sword, defending Islam against its enemies. Kevlar, a dense material that resists penetration by bullets and can be woven into many forms. U.S. troops wear Kevlar vests with ceramic front plates inserted into specially designed pockets. The U.S. military helmet is also made of Kevlar. Kia, killed in action. Kurds, a tribal people of the Middle East, most of whom live in Turkey, northeast Iraq, and Iran. Kurds are the second largest ethnic group in Iraq, where they maintain an area of autonomous control. LOC, lines of communication. LOC ensure combat soldiers have essential access to supplies, intelligence, and advice from rear services and commanders. M16, the standard infantry rifle of the U.S. Army, Medevac, the abbreviation for medical evacuation, the process by which wounded soldiers are quickly moved by helicopters or ground vehicles to hospital centers, MAL, modular lightweight load-carrying equipment. A MAL vest has special webbing and loops that can hold personal armor and upon which other equipment can be fastened. MOS, military occupational specialty. The job a soldier has been trained to perform. MRE, meals ready to eat. Individual rations carried by soldiers in the field, NCO, non-commissioned officers. Any soldiers above the rank of private, for example, sergeants, corporals, etc. POW, prisoner of war, PSYOP, psychological operations. PSYOP military units are specially trained to give useful information to local inhabitants to encourage their cooperation and influence their support of U.S. objectives. Red Crescent, Middle Eastern equivalent of the Red Cross. A white flag with a red crescent moon on it denotes an organization or vehicle that's on an errand of mercy and, according to international treaties, should be immune to attack. RO, rules of engagement are established by U.S. military authorities and define when and what kind of force U.S. soldiers can engage in. RPG, the rocket-propelled grenade is a shoulder-fired weapon with an effective range of up to 500 yards. It is favored by Iraqi insurgents because of its lightweight. Rules of war, internationally agreed upon laws and treaties, such as the Geneva Conventions. Rules of war define humanitarian issues, such as the protection of civilians and how prisoners of war and war wounded are treated, and outline which war activities are prohibited, such as attacks on hospitals or Red Cross or Red Crescent vehicles or the deliberate killing of civilians who are not directly involved in combat. SAW, squad automatic weapon. A light or medium-sized machine gun, sheikh, an Arabic term applied to a tribal elder, wise man, leader, or highly respected person, Shiite, a follower of Islam who believes that the leadership of the Islamic religion should have been the descendants of Ali, the cousin and son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad. Shiites are the second largest branch of Islam. The majority of Iraqis are Shiites. Squad, a group of soldiers. Squad size may vary according to the needs of the mission. Sunni, a follower of Islam who believes that the caliphs, or rulers, who took control after the death of the Prophet Muhammad were the rightful leaders of their religion. Sunnis make up the largest branch of Islam but are a minority in Iraq. Tribe, a group of people who have family, religious, and language ties. Up armored, the additional armor added is needed to vehicles in the field, WIA, wounded in action, WMD, weapons of mass destruction,